Well, I had a birthday this week, and I almost brought my birthday present, wore it today. Janet and Peter got me a t-shirt with the picture of the owl that lives in the trees right next to our house, right on the front of the t-shirt, but I thought those two yellow eyes looking out at you might spook you. But it's really a beautiful shirt, and I really love it. What a gift. And a gift of life. Life is a gift. I don't know how you feel about this last 2 years, but this has been the strangest, craziest 2 years of my life. Runaway inflation. You know, COVID-19, a pandemic, locked us all down. I think of the kids who were locked out of school. Students stuck at home, masks hid people's faces. Church doors closed. A loss of freedom here and in Canada. You know, we had hoped, and a lot of us believed, that racism was fading. But an officer's knee on a black man's neck activated a subterranean volcano of anger. And we found that critical race theory is being taught now in our schools. The war in Ukraine. You know, this last week they passed a bill in Los Angeles that they will have drag day in all of our schools so the kids can dress in drag. You wonder sometimes, are we going to survive all this? Change is happening so fast. Do you feel insecure anymore in the world? You know, we have cancel culture. Have you been canceled yet? You know, God has a book, a whole book for times like these. It's called the Book of Esther. Now, we know Sunday's Mother's Day, and I wanted to honor one of the women, the heroes of the Bible, Esther. Written for people who feel outnumbered by their foes, people who are outmaneuvered by fate, written for people that are outdone and overcome with fear. Does that sound like anybody you know? God wrote this book, put it in His Word. I think it's as if He heard the prayers of everybody that was afraid and said, listen, I've got a message for you. He escorts us to the front row of a grand theater. And He invites us to take a seat. The curtain opens and we're eyewitnesses to the great controversy in miniature. It's the triumph of a divine drama. Do you know there's only two books in the Bible that God has never mentioned? And Esther's one of them, the other one's Song of Solomon. And it doesn't mention prayer in either book. The cast is four characters. It consists of Xerxes, the king. He had a thirst for wine, a disregard for women, convictions that changed with the weather, and a man who had very little moral absolutes. His name in Hebrew is Ahasuerus, but his name in Greek, Xerxes, and I like any name that has two X's in it, so I choose Xerxes. It was written to be read in times like this. The first person, of course, is in the cast is Xerxes. The Book of Esther portrays him kind of as a wimp, an accomplished drinker. He delegates decision and he doesn't make anything that we know of like a statesman-like decree or some profound thoughts, no moral absolutes. Then there's Haman. He's the villain of the story. Tyrant, wealthy. He's the has the ear of the king, and he's kind of the enforcer. Then there's Mordecai the Jew. Mordecai had a cousin whom he brought up, tells us in Esther 2, verse 7. Says she was beautiful. Said that she had a lovely figure. According to the Jews, there were only four women in the Bible that were really beautiful. Esther, Sarah, Rahab, and Abigail. Are you sensing the elements of a drama here? I mean, you could make a Hollywood movie out of this, couldn't you? Clueless brute of a king, devious, heartless, bloodthirsty Haman, Mordecai, defiant, and then beautiful Esther. Where is God in the story? Why the absence of spirituality? Why the seemingly silence of God? You ever ask yourself that question? You ever prayed and says, where is God when I need him? Seems like he's long gone away or distant. This book reminds us that he need not be loud to be strong. He need not cast a shadow for his presence to be there. We see the evidence of God throughout this book. In fact, I've called it peripety. Peripety, I'll say it right. Now, does anybody know what it means? Not one English major in the crowd? Aha! But I bet you knew what it meant. Yes. Oh, yeah. I love it. Every good author has one. It's what keeps you up late at night when you say, wow, I didn't see that coming. Do you know, as I studied this book, I found there's at least 12 turns, complete turnarounds, that only God could orchestrate. So where is God? He's all over there. There's three acts in this story. The first is confusion. The people of God have rejected God and the truth about God, and as a result, they're living in as slaves in Babylon. They were taken, you remember, Nebuchadnezzar came and took over the city of Jerusalem, and the people were taken prisoner, and they're now living down in Persia. God's people chose the glamour of Persia over the goodness of God. What a poor choice. And compromise begins to replace conviction. Has that ever happened around your world? The second one is the crisis. A decree of death places all the Jews on life support. What hope does a fringe group have in a pagan society? That's where we live. We're a fringe group in a pagan society. The third act is unimaginable happiness. God flips everything on its head. We serve a God who loves to do that for his faithful children. When you stand up for him, he stands up for you. Isn't that good news? The theme of the book of Esther, as well as the theme of the Bible, is really about God turning the injustices of the world on their head. God's going to do it. For some of us, it doesn't seem like it's soon enough. But God's in control. When all seems lost, I want you to know it's not. God still has his final say. Even though today may look like the devil's day, it may look like he's winning, I'll tell you, I can promise you one thing, God will win in the end. God has a Joseph for every famine. He has a David for every Goliath. He even has a Rahab to call into service a madam when he needs somebody to deliver the spies and to save his people. He calls an Egyptian princess into service when he gives her compassion for a little baby in the bulrushes. God has a person in every emergency. He has you for what's going on in the world today. He had someone in this story called Esther. Here's the way the story begins. Esther 1, verse 3. In the third year of the reign of Xerxes, he gave a banquet for all the nobles and officials and military leaders of Persia and Media. The princes, the nobles of the province were all present. Now, I want you to think about Xerxes. I want to give you a little background. He's 35 years old. He's rich beyond imagination. His palace boasted hangings of linens of blue and white and beautiful colors. There was onyx and marble floors and mother of pearl and costly stones. The palace had 36 columns that stood 70 feet tall. Each column was crowned with bulls that were carved that held up the big cedar beams of the ceiling. When Alexander the Great entered the palace of Susa a century later, he discovered in today's dollars the equivalent of $54.5 billion. And that research I could find was old, more than that. There was actually 270 tons of minted gold coins. He had staged a six-month party. For full 180 days, he displayed his vast wealth of his kingdom and his splendor and his glory and his majesty. He gave a banquet at the end of the 180 days. He started a seven-day banquet to feed all these people that had come in. But toward the end of the carnival, day 187, his true colors begin to come forth. Verse 10 says, in high spirits from wine, not a good combination, tipsy Xerxes decided to show off his wife Vashti because she was beautiful. And according to the Midrash, he asked her to come in wearing nothing but a crown. Now, we can't prove that. The Bible doesn't say that. But I don't think he had there to talk about. He had her there to talk about things of the state. You see, he wanted to flaunt her. Persia was not safe for women. Females, including the queen, were property. Vashti spent most of her time cloistered and pampered and preened for her next appearance before the king. She refused to comply. Bless her heart. Someone with values. But the king became furious, verse 12 tells us. Here, I want you to picture this. Here's this strong, rich Xerxes in control of the whole world. In fact, it went all the way from Punjabi in India, all the way to Khartoum, 4,460 miles. He had over 50 million people under his control at that time. Here he is showing off his wealth in front of his 127 provinces and all the leadership, and he's undone the last day by his wife. She refuses to comply. So he's made to look like a wimp in front of all his friends. Well, verse 12 says the king became furious and burned with anger. Verse 16 and 17 says, "The queen's conduct will become known to all women, so they will despise their husbands and say, 'King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come.'" Fellows, he said, we've got to act. We cannot stand to have women think that they can do whatever they want. They have to be subservient to us men. Why, you never know, they might think that they have a life outside the kitchen. So he calls his seven drunk friends. And they say, "What can be done?" "Oh," they said, "tell Vashti she's never to come before the king again, and you pick out somebody that's more worthy than her." Chapter 2 begins with the word, "after these things." I did a little research. I found it was 4 years later. During those 4 years, after Vashti's humiliation of Xerxes, during those 4 years, he made an ambitious but disastrous attempt to overthrow Greece. Greece was getting stronger. He failed. But when he came back, he realized he had no queen, no one to comfort him. So that's when he decided, well, they said to choose somebody else. And so he began to set the guys in his realm looking for the young virgins to come and apply for Vashti's position. If you look at the different sources on this one, I've read that there was between 400 young women came. I've heard as high as 1,460 young women. Now remember, to be a Jew was to be called out, set apart. But Mordecai was on the payroll of a pagan king. Now, I want to ask you a question. The word Mordecai is an adaptation of the word Marduk, which is one of the Babylonian gods. Now, how in the world does a Jew get named after a Babylonian god? Would a Jew today name his son Mohammed? I don't think so. So what happened? I think the answer can be found in chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. It says, "Mordecai was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive by Jehoiachin, king of Judah." Mordecai was three generations removed from Israel, living out the pagan name he was given. He went clandestine with his convictions. Mordecai had a cousin, tells us in verse 7, named Hadasha. Now, Hadasha in the Hebrew means myrtle, and we're also told it means righteous. But guess what? She also had a Babylonian name. Esther is in reference to one of the Persian gods called Ishtar, which is a goddess of fertility. So look in chapter 2, verse 10. It says, "Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so." So stop and think about it. Mordecai hid his heritage, and he encouraged his young cousin to do the same. So they're living a false life. Go along to get along. The polytheistic Persians did not require conquered peoples to give up their gods. All they said was, "Just worship our gods too." This proved problematic for the Jews, because every Jew says the Shema every morning and every night. The Shema is from Deuteronomy 5, 5 and 6. The Shema starts out, "Listen, people of Israel, the Lord our God is the only Lord. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength. And they repeated that every single morning and every night. Every Jew had to do that. The question of the psalmist in Psalms 137:4 is the question that Esther was dealing with and Mordecai, and it's the question you and I have to deal with. It says there, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? How do the person of faith live in a faithless world? You know, that's a choice, that's a decision we all have to make. You know, they said, why risk angering the king? What good comes from disclosing the truth? I can worship a Persian gods and the God and the true God, right? I can change my name and work for the king, right? I can keep my identity secret and sleep with the king, right? They created a world of hidden identity. Mordecai kept his Hebrew ancestry a secret. By the time we meet Mordecai and Esther, they buried their Jewish identity beneath layer after layer of compromise. Being politically correct is something that's not new. Which brings me to another question. The compulsion to hide our identity as children of God affects us all. Remember Peter? When the little girl said, you're one of his followers? Peter said, not me. Oh, no, she said later on, you sound like a Galilean. And then he began to sound like a trucker. I'm sorry. He began to sound like a sailor. Maybe that's better. No, that's worse. The compulsion to hide our identity affects us all. Our society permits all beliefs except an exclusive one. Do whatever you want as long as you applaud what everybody else does. The value of Western culture is tolerance. It's amazing to me how intolerant the champions of tolerance are, especially in a religion like you and I have, that adheres to one Savior and one solution to the human problem. And they call it hate speech. Five years have passed since Esther was appointed queen. She won the beauty contest. She now lives the life of luxury. Life has been good to her and Mordecai. He serves at the seat of power. She lives in the lap of luxury. But then all is good until Mordecai overhears a plot. It's found in chapter 2, 21 to 23. I'd like to read it. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, and two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, were doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king of Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. No public recognition, no gold watch, no explanation. Aha, I think we get an explanation in chapter 3, verse 1. It says there, after these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. Xerxes had first been betrayed by his wife. Now he's betrayed by people within his own court that are trying to kill him. And so what does he do? He hires a hitman, a strong arm to protect him. Haman and his hate begins to make for high drama. chapter 3, verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down nor pay him honor. Why? All of a sudden, why is he growing a backbone? What happens? His resistance, verse 4 tells us, went on day after day. His fellow court members spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them. Finally, they got an explanation. Mordecai, I told him that he was a Jew. You see, Saul had been told to kill Agai, the king, and he had not, and then some others had escaped as well, and this was an enemy of God's people from centuries before, and he's still living. And when the camouflage came off, the mask was removed. Mordecai had spent his life hiding his nationality, and he trained Esther to do the same, but finally there came a point in time where he could take it no more, and he wasn't going to bow down to an enemy of God's people. And Haman went ballistic. Chapter 3, 5, and 6. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Ethnic cleansing is not something new. Haman embarked on a mission to annihilate all of God's chosen people. Who do you think was behind it? Yep. And he cast lots, you know, he threw dice. It's an interesting thing to determine the date of the execution, and it fell on 11 months in the future. You know, dice have six numbers, and they have six on both, 12. There's 12 months in a year. They threw dice to determine what month and what day of the month. And the word for dice in Hebrew is pur, P-U-R. And so it's what they did. Look at verse 8 and 9. There was a certain people. He goes to the king now with his design. There are certain people dispersed among the peoples of the province of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people. Shouldn't ours be different? Yes. Some of them were following some of the truth that they knew. And they do not obey the king's laws. Not when they go against the laws of God, they shouldn't. And it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it please the king, let the decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's royal treasury, $20 million to practice ethnic cleansing. And the king said, keep the money, but go ahead and do as you like with these people, whatever you think best. Then the king and Haman sat down for a drinking spree, and the city fell into confusion. Can you imagine the insensitivity? You've just put a death decree on everybody. You've given them 11 months to think about it. And then you go sit down and have a beer. Oh, a wine, whatever. Get drunk. Proverbs 16:33 says, people throw lots, that's pure, to make a decision. But the answer comes from the Lord. Comes from who? Comes from God. Chance didn't determine the date. God did. You see, God wanted time for His plan to unfold. It was God who delayed the date 11 months, giving His time, His plan, time to happen. It was God who reminded Mordecai of his ancestry and his identity. It was God who prompted him finally to take a stand. Living as a person of faith in a faithless world requires courage, and it requires acts of resistance. Maybe sometimes even acts of civil resistance. You won't be told, I don't think, to kneel before a Persian tyrant. But chances are, you'll be tempted to compromise what you believe and what you know is true, or remain silent in the face of injustice because you don't want to make waves. Chapter 4, 1 and 2, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, what did he do? He tore his clothes and he had a fit. He went into town and he beat his chest and he went screaming around all over the place, put himself in sackcloth and ashes. When she heard about it, she sent him a batch of new clothing and told him to straighten up. So, what's the matter with you? Apparently, she was unaware of the extermination order that had gone out. And so he sends her a message. I want you to look at chapter 4. I want you to look at the message that I think she was unaware of the decree. And so he sent her a message. Look at chapter 4, verse 11. All the king's officials and people of the royal province now know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court, you know, he sends this message to her and tells her what he expects. But in verse 11, she starts to make all these excuses. He sends the extermination order, and she starts to make these excuses. It's against the law. It's been 30 days since he's even taken a second look at me. He's in a foul mood. He'll probably kill me like he did Vashti. It was a call to courage from her cousin. Sometimes all we need from one another is a call to courage, to step forward, to be counted, to make a difference. But look at chapter 4, 13 and 14. Here's his message that Mordecai gives to his young cousin. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at a time of relief, at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. When circumstances leave you desperate, I think Mordecai's words are worth telling. No one gets a free pass. In this life, you're going to have trouble. Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble, John 16:33. 2 Corinthians, he puts it another way. You'll pass through the waters, you'll pass through the rivers, you'll walk through the fire, Isaiah 43:2. Troubles come with life. We gain nothing by pretending that they don't. No one gets a free pass. But one way or another, deliverance will come. The question is, will you be a part of it? Will you be on God's team? God's going to bring deliverance. It's just a matter of, are we going to be part of that answer to somebody else's prayer? And maybe even our own. When he learned of the order to kill all the Jews, in chapter 4, verse 1, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth. But in 13 verses later, he says relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews. What made the difference? What changed his attitude? I think he remembered that there is a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There is a God who, even though they had no army, no temple, no priesthood, no sacrifices, no matter, they still had Jehovah God. In this world, Jesus said, you will have trouble, but be of good cheer. Take heart. I have overcome the world. 2 Corinthians 1 verse 9, I love these. We need to remind ourselves of these promises. He says, indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. And I like that one in Isaiah 43:2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. With through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. Don't you love those promises of God? We need to claim them. This was the message Mordecai gave. Relief is coming. Who knows but what you have your royal position for such a time as this. You see, God has a purpose, and you're that purpose. The faith of Hadassah begins to emerge. What happens from I can't do anything till I'm willing to do something? I'm willing to lose everything. What took her from if I go, I'll perish, to if I perish, I'll perish? What changed her attitude? I think that when Mordecai gave the message, it opened a window of faith in his cousin. And she began. It shed that divine light into Esther's world. And she realized that she was there for a reason. Your life is part of a plan. You were placed here for a purpose. Deliverance will come. God will have his victory. He will rescue his people. He will right the wrongs of this world. The question is not will God prevail. The question is, are you going to be on his team? Are you going to stand up and speak up? Or are you going to continue to live in compromise? You know, Esther did a wonderful thing. Always before, she had relied on her beauty to get what she wanted. But this time, she called everybody to fast. And we know what goes with fasting, prayer. It's not mentioned, but that's what they were doing. And rather than rush into Xerxes' room, she humbled herself and stepped into the throne room of the God of the universe. Until this point, she had relied on her good looks. Now, she switches and relies on the power of God. She will soon risk her life, but her only hope, her only faith is in God. And this time in chapter 5, verse 2, when she went in after she had spent time in the throne room of God, he says he was pleased with her and held out the golden scepter. And it wasn't the glamour that opened the throne room that day. It was the power of her God. Chapter 5 opens with Esther re-robed in royalty, standing in the inner court, just close enough for the king to catch a glimpse of her. "What is it, Queen Esther?" he says. "What is your request?" "Up to half the kingdom, I'll give it to you." Which tells us that she must have had a pretty good relationship with him. Esther requested a dinner date. A nice evening, wonderful food. Haman was invited. The evening was a great success. Haman felt full belly and a big head. Life was good. He was the king's in-house counsel and the queen's go-to black tie guy. Haman went home as cheerless as anyone you can imagine, because as he walked by the gate, here was Mordecai in sackcloth and ashes, and he still wouldn't bow as the king had commanded. And so he goes home to his wife. It's in chapter 5, 12 to 14. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet that she gave. She invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a pole set up, reaching to the height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go to the king at the banquet, enjoy yourself." It says the suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. You see, they didn't have a hangman in those days. They had a pole. They built a big scaffolding and shoved somebody off on a pole, and they skewered him. Speaking of sleep, that night, Haman went to sleep dreaming of Mordecai on a pole. Xerxes couldn't sleep that night, and instead, because he couldn't sleep, he asked for the reading of the minutes of the last meeting. And guess what they read? All of a sudden, Mordecai saved the king's life by reporting an assassination attempt. What? Said the king. Are you kidding me? What's been done for this man? Nothing. When he learned that nothing had been done to honor and save the life of the one who'd saved him, he was upset. How could this be? Mordecai had protected the crown and received nothing in return. And so he needed some advice. And who was standing in the courtyard but Haman? He says, invite him in. So Haman comes in and he says, what should be done to the one the king likes to delight? And Haman, with his huge ego, says, it's got to be me. I'll tell you what to do. He said, for the man the king delights to honor, have him bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden on, and put the royal crest on his head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to the one the king most noble princes. And let them ride the man through the city, saying, this is the one that the king delights to honor. Lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what's done to the man the Lord, the king likes to honor. Great, king says, go and do it. Now, I want you to stop and think about it. What happened next is one of, I think, the greatest moments in the Bible. Get the robe, the horse, and just to do, you know, here he wants, he envisions Mordecai being skewed. He's already built the scaffolding, and instead he's leading him through the city on a horse. You know, he wanted to lead him to a scaffolding and jeers, and instead he's leading him through the streets to cheers. You know, another huge flip-flop. Ponder the plight of Haman, the outcome of Mordecai. God flip-flopped their stories. Haman begins the day large and in charge, walking in the king's quarters. Mordecai began the day wearing sackcloth and ashes, praying in the shadow of a 7-foot scaffolding that had his name on it. Yet Haman is humiliated. Mordecai is elevated. Haman's death decree is silly putty in the hands of God and in the hands of his province. The next time you hear somebody say the devil's in the details, correct them. It's God in the details. He's always working behind the scenes to work out his purpose for our lives. Haman, the villain in Esther's story. So much has happened since the feast. He goes to the second dinner. The first one Esther didn't say what the problem was, but this time, King Haman went to the Queen Esther's banquet. As they were drinking wine on the second day, the king asked again, Queen Esther, what is your petition? What can I give you? What's your request? Up to half the kingdom. This time, the king answered, if I found favor, verse 3 and 4, chapter 7, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold and to be destroyed and killed and annihilated. And if we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress should disturb the king. Now she reveals that she's Jewish. She reveals her identity. I think the king's head was spinning. What? He must have said, he couldn't even connect the dots. Who is it that's trying to kill my queen and kill all the Jews? Who's doing this? And then in verse 5 and 6, Esther says, our enemy and foe is this wicked Haman. Haman began to tremble. I can't imagine. I think all the blood must have drained out of his face. The king stormed out of the room. He was angry at Haman for playing him as the fool. He was angry at himself for being the fool. He threw himself on the mercy of Esther. Now, here's another big flip. He was mad because a Jew wouldn't bow to him. Now he's bowing down and actually groping at the queen when the king comes back in. The guards hooded Haman They took him into custody, verse 8. And I think somebody suggested, hey, you know, there's a nice pole out here. And that'd be a good thing to do with him. And I think Haman got the point. Chapter 9 opens with these words, and I'm finishing. Chapter 9, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But it says, now the tables were turned. The Jews got the upper hand of those who hated them. The God's Word translation says the exact opposite happened. English Standard Version says the reverse occurred. The Berean Study Bible says their plan was overturned. The New American Standard says it turned out to the contrary. You see, God is the God of the plot twist. There's 12 of them that I found in this story. Exactly what happened in Esther's case, God softened a hard heart, and so she asked again for to save the people, and he said, well, write a law. And so they wrote another law in chapter 8, verse 8. And the king granted that the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and defend themselves, and they had 9 months to get ready. On the very day the Jews were destined to die, they dealt a blow to the anti-Semitic empire, killing 75,000 of the king's men that were anti-Semitic. Haman's terror was defanged, and God won the victory. It's a perpetrary parade. God is not mentioned, but we see evidence of him all through the story. Sometimes we look at places like Ukraine, and we think, when's God going to put an end to it? God sees, God understands, and in the end, God will have his way. In Esther 4:3, there's great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. But when you get to chapter 8, verse 16, it says, for the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy and rejoicing. No individual, no organization, no institution, no nation is beyond the power of God. He works for the good of those who love him. Relief will come. The question is, will you be a part of it? Our world is in chaos. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. God needs a people who will stand up and be counted. Are you going to be one of them? Or are you going to go along to get along? Bombs are still dropping. Worlds are still exploding. Walls still collapse. Pandemics still rage. But in the midst of it all, the Lord has a people. And they have a message of truth to proclaim to the world. And the world needs to hear it. I like that song, the church has one foundation. It's Jesus Christ, her Lord. She is his new creation by Spirit and the Word. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he bought her, and for her life he died. I want you to look at chapter 8, verse 17. I want to show you one final twist in this story. And it's found in this verse. It says, in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy, gladness, and a feast and a holiday. Look at the next two words. Then many of the people of the land became Jews. We don't convert the world when we don't stand up for truth. It says, and because the fear of the Jews had come upon them. They weren't afraid of them. The word also means respect. God wants a people to stand up for Him. Will you be one of them? It's my prayer that God will use us in a mighty way, that He'll give us courage like Esther and Mordecai. We may have compromised in the past, but there comes a time we need to stand up and be counted.